We're going to have three panels this morning. The first will focus on the impact of consolidation on the news. The second will focus on music and entertainment. And the third will focus a bit more generally on localism. We'll ask each panelist to limit their opening remarks to 5 minutes so that we'll have adequate time for questions and discussions. We have a timekeeper. Where is Jordan Goldstein? He's over here, and he'll be raising his hand when there's a minute to go on this. I'm going to introduce just very briefly each of the panelists right now, and then we can just go down without interruption with their presentations. As I said, the first panel will consider the impact of media consolidation on local news. One of our FCC studies that our staff prepared claims that consolidation has not harmed the quality of news programming offered by local stations. But another recent study by the Project for Excellence in Journalism found just the opposite, that smaller station groups overall tended to produce higher quality newscasts than stations owned by larger companies. Today we're going to hear from those familiar with the issue in the Pacific Northwest and try to get behind the generalities and down to some specifics. We are much honored by our distinguished first panel. As I said, I will just give a brief introduction of all of them. First, it's a special pleasure to welcome U.S. Representative Jay Inslee here this morning. I had the pleasure of working with Congressman Inslee when he first came to Washington. I was at the Department of Commerce at the time on increasing trade opportunities around the world for this part of the country, and I enjoyed working with him immensely. He's an active representative for Washington State, one of Congress's leading advocates for consumers and the public interest. He works frequently with the news media, obviously, to communicate policy issues to the public. He authored the Internet Radio Fairness Act in order to ensure radio formatting, diversity in radio formatting in the face of extensive homogenization of terrestrial radio, and he brings tremendous public experience to this panel. After Congressman Inslee, we will hear from Frank Blethyn, the publisher of the Seattle Times, a community and a corporate leader who I know needs no introduction to most of you in this audience. He is a distinguished journalist. He is a deep thinker about the profession of journalism and the operation of America's media generally, and he looks at it against a deeply felt appreciation of the public interest. He's received so many awards and commendations it would probably take a half an hour to go through them all, but he's very distinguished, and we're glad to have him here. Third, we have Alan Stavitsky, the Associate Dean of the School of Journalism and Communication at the University of Oregon. He is a distinguished teacher and also a distinguished student of journalism. He's written extensively on a number of communications issues. We're proud to have him here. And fourth, we have David Lugi, the president and general manager of King and Kong here in Seattle. He also heads the Northwest Cable News. He has an impressive career in running station news operations. He has received a number of Murrow Awards and done a lot of community work, too. So we're delighted to have all of you here, and we'll begin with Representative Inslee.
Thank you. Thought I'd start with a quote by a fellow who figured it out a long time ago that's particularly salient this morning. Thomas Jefferson said, "An enlightened citizenry is indispensable for the proper functioning of the republic." And Thomas Jefferson would be spinning in his grave today if he knew the federal government was considering adoption of a rule that would reduce the number of voices of information that reach the American people. And the reason that I think it's appropriate to make that rather bold statement is that if you loosen the consolidation laws, if you remove the laws against consolidation, you will get more consolidation. This seems to be a conclusion that even Oregon Ducks could reach, I hope, if I could say that.
That was cheap.
With all due apology, we're trying to show the appropriate respect here. And the reason that's so dangerous is consolidation, it seems to be a relatively benign word. It sounds solid, consolidation. But consolidation means, by necessity, that people have access to fewer opinions, fewer parts of the spectrum, fewer parts of the geography, fewer different approaches to the arts and science and politics by necessity. And so I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say this withdrawal, the potential removal of these consolidation rules by necessity, will result in Americans having less access to diversity, certainly, and probably less access to local opinions. Now, why is that important? It's important because, truly, as Jim said, the airways belong to the American people. And I understand, because I was a dog here once and I majored in economics, and one of the things I learned was the economies of scale. We learned, certainly, the economies of scale is actually, it's not a myth, it's a reality. You can produce more for less amount of money if you have a larger scale of production. And when you're producing widgets, that's a good idea. But the median today does not produce widgets. It produces democracy. And for that reason, we have to be particularly attentive to the aspect and the value of diversity as opposed to just efficiency in the production of bits of information. And it's for that reason that I think the value of the FCC needs to look at this more than just efficiency. And I want to thank these two gentlemen for your personal contribution to this effort. Because to me, the fact that the electronic media in particular has basically totally ignored the basic restructuring of this industry and not allowed Americans to know what's going on in their federal government, coupled with the fact we haven't got the full commission to come around the country, this sort of conspiracy of silence proves the point, and it proves the necessity of having more voices rather than fewer. And I may note that, when we considered the roadless rule, when the federal government considered the roadless rule for our national forest, we had 600 public hearings around the country. 600 public hearings. Unfortunately, some of your friends couldn't get west of Virginia, and I really appreciate your personal efforts. Thank you very much to recognize us. This is not just sort of a temporary interest of mine. We had some success this year passing the bill that will preserve the webcasting industry, because I believe that we need to multiply the channels that are available to people. And for those of you who are interested in the dog radio, I hope it's going to take off, because we passed this fall a provision to make sure that copyright royalties don't drive webcasters out of business. So it's a good success. And we're going to keep working on that. But if I can, let me just point to the empirical evidence. If we want to see empirical evidence, I'll put some on the record. And it's been said before. Since the 1996 reduction of consolidation rules in radio, we have 34% fewer radio station owners. We have 34% fewer diverse voices making opinions and information available to Americans. And I want to show you that, to show a little humility here, in an editorial that in the Seattle Times today, my editorial said 34% less stations. It meant to say station owners, and just so not even congressmen are omnipotent and always correct. And that's why we need multiple voices. You can't always trust even one congressman. We made one little editorial mistake there. And we've seen 90% of the top 10 cable networks 90% of the top cable controlled by 10 outfits. And the reason I point that out is that there's been this myth created that the technology would do away, that the multiplicity of different technologies of cable and broadband and the like would remove the necessity for public regulation of the airwaves. Nothing could be further from the truth. And the reason is we found that the multiplication of technologies essentially ends up with the same voices, but just on different channels. And that's why the reduction in ownership is the important fact to look at, the reduction of 34% of the number of owners, the reduction in the number of sources of information cannot be covered up by the increase in number of channels of distribution. And that's why we think it's imperative that the creation of broadband has not reduced the necessity of preserving this fundamental aspect. So I want to thank you for your efforts, and I look forward to this discussion.
Thank you, Congressman. Mr. Blevin.
Today, barely 10% of our nation's newspapers remain independent and connected to their communities. Today, five giant companies dominate our country's electronic media. Today, a small group of corporations control all the cable access to our home. For the most part, these media corporations are now driven by a class of professional financial managers concerned only by short-term stock prices. Not journalism, not public trust, and not democracy. Only 30 years ago, there were 1,500 daily newspapers, almost all privately owned and operated by people living in the communities which they served. Conglomeratization of American business has placed control over almost every aspect of our lives in the hands of ever-shrinking number of powerful corporate elites. Corporate conglomeration shows no signs of abating. Indeed, its potential for abuse has been exacerbated by another trend that is even more frightening. That trend is the control increasingly vested in Wall Street and managed solely for the short-term financial goals of investors. This combination of size and Wall Street control has many negative consequences on hardworking American employees across the country. It has hurt our economy and it has hurt our local communities. The trend is bad in any business, but it is devastating in the news and media business. Our nation's newsrooms have been seriously victimized by this trend. Is it any wonder that so many Americans are feeling disconnected and underinformed? The foundation of American democracy is a free, diverse, and independent press. The principle is so important that the press is the only business protected by our Constitution. Implicit is the understanding that freedom can only exist if the practice of journalism, the generation of news, and the control of information and distribution is not limited, and that there exists a wide variety of independent news and media owners representing our nation's rich diversity of culture, geography, and thought. The Seattle Times is one of America's last remaining independent, locally operated newspaper and website businesses. For more than a century, my family's singular focus has been to provide fiercely independent journalism for the communities we live in. We grew up in these communities. We raised our children in these communities, and we plan to stay in these communities. We are also a sophisticated business enterprise. We must be to survive. And we know firsthand we do not need to own a TV station to survive. Repealing the cross-ownership ban and relaxing the other concentration rules would not only be a serious blow to America's independent free press, it may be a fatal blow to our democracy. The companies now controlling our nation's media and information channels have already become too large, too faceless, and too financially driven. We must keep protections in place to preserve democracy. I have heard the conglomerates claim that the market demands less regulation and more concentration. This is a key argument they make to the FCC in their well-funded and well-organized lobbying campaign. What markets are these that demand greater concentration ownership? It's certainly not the consumer of news, and it's certainly not the citizens in our democracy. Indeed, they are the financial markets, demanding relentless growth to drive stock price. There's nothing wrong with making a profit. To survive, a news organization must have financial strength to allow independent journalism. But solid profitability to fund news operations is quite different than Wall Street's insistence on ever higher profits. Conglomerates who own newspapers boast about newspaper cash flow margins in the 20 to 30% range. Yes, you heard me right, 20 to 30%. And they also boast that their TV stations operate in a 40 to 50% cash flow margin, and you heard me right there, too. It doesn't pass a smirk test to claim that newspapers and television stations with cash flow margins in the 20 to 50% range have serious marketplace and competitive challenges. I submit what we already know, that these high margins are a way to hold stock prices up, and that with each passing decade, these companies squeeze out more and more of the news and journalism that is essential to an informed citizenry. Investigative journalism, explanatory journalism, and strong local content all cost money. Eventually, Wall Street squeezes out the most important journalism and replaces it with inexpensive and bland wire service material, programming, and entertainment features. The other myth the conglomerates put forth is that the internet and cable have provided us with information and access proliferation, so the FCC concentration rules are out of date. This is not true. The internet is a lot of things, but it is not a reliable source of credible original news and information. And 150 channels of cable simply means we now have 140, which we rarely, if ever, watch. The lack of coverage of this debate in last week's hearing have already been noted. I would submit that as you see the money changers replacing the storytellers, we have seen the most egregious and alarming consequence of newspaper and media owner concentration. That is, how quickly America's newsrooms have been transformed from democracy's watchdog into corporate lapdogs. There is no public interest justification or business rationale for repealing the cross-ownership ban. If it is repealed, we will see an ugly media conglomerate feeding frenzy as the major players realign newspaper and broadcast station ownerships in major markets with no sensitivity to the citizens in these communities. Apparently, the courts have said that the Commission's rules must be justified and based on needs. What greater need is there, and what higher obligation does the Commission have than preserving our democracy? Whether Wall Street cares or not, the airwaves in this country are owned by the public, and the FCC's responsibility is to protect the public's interest. I implore the Commission and Congress to listen carefully to the fast-growing grassroots voice of the American public and protect us from further media concentration and further erosion of our democracy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blythe. And Dean Stavitsky.
Thank you, commissioners, and welcome to the Northwest, home to ducks as well as dogs. Glad to have you here. Allow me to begin, please, with a personal note. When I graduated from the University of Wisconsin with my bachelor's degree 25 years ago, I went to work for a small, locally owned AM-FM radio combo outside of Madison. Many of my classmates were similarly hired at small stations across the country. We were country music and top 40 disc jockeys. We called play-by-play of high school sports, represented the stations at county fairs. And most important, we reported on city councils, school boards, and other community events. Today, most of those jobs don't exist. Those mom-and-pop owners generally sold out to out-of-town chains. Their programming generally comes via satellite from distant sources. And there's usually no one live and local on the air to report the lost dogs, read the school lunch menus, or even broadcast weather warnings. But what's most serious in my view is that local news is disappearing from American radio. And that's what I'd like to talk a bit about with you this morning. The roots of this situation are complex. Technological advances in program distribution played a role, certainly, and contributed to a renaissance of radio networks and syndicators eager to offer their programming to local stations. Computer technology brought us the radio station in a box. It's now possible to run your audio off a hard drive instead of tapes, to pull your disc jockey's patter off the bird, to punch up software that will run the commercial breaks and the station IDs, and a manager can walk away knowing that the computer will keep you on the air 24/7. At the same time, as broadcasters were being empowered by these digital advances, deregulatory policies were freeing broadcasters from many of their longstanding content obligations. Past commissions eliminated requirements for public affairs programming, for community ascertainment, that was, as was noted earlier, and the Fairness Doctrine. In addition, the FCC began easing the limits on radio station ownership, which ultimately culminated in Section 202 of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which repealed all of the national ownership caps. And that started the radio merger frenzy that that we see to this day. Stations changed hands frequently, sometimes multiple times in 1 year. New managers came in looking to cut costs in light of their new heavy corporate debt loads and the desire to increase profit margins. They know, of course, that news coverage is expensive, and so news staffs frequently took cuts. Recent data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics showed sharp declines in radio employment, and much of that has taken place in radio newsrooms. So taken together, then, what does this context mean for radio journalism? Well, it means that hundreds of stations now outsource their news, if they have news at all. Services such as Metro Networks will customize newscast for their radio clients across the country, but it means nonetheless that everyone is getting the same repackaged stories. Chains such as Clear Channel feed news from their regional hubs to their stations. So, for instance, a station in Medford, Oregon may carry a station on its air about an event in Medford, but the story was likely written and reported by a journalist in Portland who probably pulled the information off the wire in the first place. Many of the local radio reporters, as I noted, are gone. I would challenge you to find a radio journalist at a city council meeting or a school board or a state legislative hearing. And, of course, the problem is most severe in the small markets, even though these are the markets that usually lack daily newspapers and are largely ignored by the nearest TV news operations. So, as a result, many citizens lack basic civic information about their communities. The problem becomes more apparent at times of crisis, when the lack of a news presence stands out. I've seen press reports of cases in which listeners were not informed of severe weather or serious accidents because there were no live local stations on the air at the time. And the weak state of radio news was sadly evident also during the events of 9/11. Many stations, lacking news staffs, were unable to present local angles and information on the biggest story of our generation. Instead, many carried the audio feed from television networks. Now, someone looking at data on radio formats might take me on by noting that news talk is the second most commonly programmed format on U.S. radio these days, right behind country music. But I would argue that news talk is a fallacy because the format is really about talk. And most of that talk is from regional or national syndicators. So excepting some major market stations, there is relatively little local talk radio these days. And once again, citizens are denied discourse about local concerns. There are some caveats. Certainly, I'm not here to argue that quality news cannot be found on the radio. There are indeed many AM commercial stations that remain true to the label of full-service radio, and journalism also remains vital on many public radio stations. But nonetheless, it's clear that the nexus of deregulation, technological change, and economic forces has taken a serious toll on radio journalism. And though, as my fellow panelists have noted, there are indeed websites and cable news channels aplenty these days, but these media are inherently centralized, and they cannot match the ability of broadcast radio to build a geographic sense of community, nor serve local needs for civic information and discourse. When you pull production out of the local context entirely, and when there's no connection at all between content and community, the public interest suffers. So I cannot conclude that improvement is on the horizon, but when technology and economics push the industry away from localism, public policy can and should push back. So in closing, I would note that policy analysis in this context and in looking at media consolidation should include examination of the changing nature of radio news programming. There have been precious few studies that have looked at the nature of local broadcast program content overall, and fewer still of radio journalism. And I would urge the Commission to gather such data and to consider issues relating to the sorry state of radio news in your policymaking in this critical area. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Lurgy.
Good morning. I want to thank Commissioners Copps and Edelstein and other organizers of today's forum for the opportunity to appear before you. I think it's appropriate you are holding this event in Seattle, one of America's most educated communities and a community on the cutting edge of new technology and information. This is a good place to discuss the future of information delivery and challenge some outdated assumptions. My purpose here today is to provide you with real-world local examples of how the public benefits from enhanced news and public affairs programming when companies like Belo, my employer, are allowed to own multiple outlets in a single local market. I got into this business because of the public interest. My mother was a judge, my father the mayor of our small town. In college, I was the head of the Colorado Public Interest Research Group. I went into journalism and became a television news director. I'm now a former news director, most recently here at King, and before that at WRC, the NBC-owned station in Washington, D.C. It's significant that Belo chose a news director to lead these three Seattle outlets. Belo's expectation of us and me is that our newscasts reflect the company's values of fairness, excellence, and inclusiveness, and presenting all sides of controversial issues and reflecting the values of this community. That's the extent of their involvement in news content at King. Neither I nor any member of King's management team has ever been pressured or influenced on any news content decision. Not once, not ever. Nor was I at NBC. And we don't do editorials. The viewers demand we give them the facts, context, and all viewpoints, but not our viewpoint. Our large, loyal viewership is absolute proof of their trust in us, and that trust is the currency of successful local TV operations. Our main station, King, provides more news and local programming than any other TV station in the Northwest, by a good margin. In just a few weeks, King's daily local program called Evening Magazine will become, to our knowledge, the first local daily program in America produced and broadcast in HDTV. You know, if anything, if my experience at Koperg, if I'd had it to do over again and journalism taught me, I would have listened better to viewpoints that didn't fit my own. Every one of our newscasts is the highest rated in its time period, and our journalists and managers are deeply connected and involved in this community. And while I appreciate and respect Jim Compton's comments earlier, who was a great and respected broadcaster, our folks here are very involved in this community. As an aside, the arts in this community right now, given the economy, are in very big trouble. I am the co-chair of this year's region-wide arts event, and we're about to do an enormous public service campaign calling on the public at large to serve a safety net for the arts in Seattle. As Congressman Inslee can attest, although discretion may not allow him to hear, our coverage of politics and public policy in Western Washington is the most extensive of Washington broadcasters. For that commitment, we recently received a Walter Cronkite Award from the Annenberg School of Journalism. Now, let me tell you how being able to own and operate a second station has allowed us to expand our local commitment on both stations, even in the midst of a terrible advertising recession in the Northwest. By being able to own and operate both King and Kong, we are able to consolidate expenses and use those efficiencies to put more resources into local news and local programming. Kong is an independent UHF station with no network programming or affiliation. It is hard to conceive of any model where a standalone station like that would be providing any local news in any market in America. So 4 years ago, after a standalone station in this market did drop its 10 p.m. newscast for economic reasons, leaving viewers in this market with only one news choice at 10 p.m., we added a daily newscast on Kong 7 nights a week, something we couldn't do on King because of NBC programming, primetime from 8 to 11, would prohibit us from doing that. Last year, in the worst advertising year in Seattle history, we added a prominent local public affairs show. The cost consolidation and programming flexibility provided by a duopoly allowed us to provide something no other Seattle broadcaster provides. Called Upfront, it doesn't just air, it airs on prime time at 10:30 p.m. on Kong and at 4:30 p.m. on King. It's worth noting that at the same time, Seattle's only locally owned network affiliate canceled their public affairs show. Until this year, we couldn't carry NBC's Meet the Press in a prominent time period on King because the network was requiring us to carry NBA basketball games at 9 a.m. on the West Coast. So instead, we carried it twice, once on King earlier in the morning, but again at Kong at 10 a.m. We made sure viewers knew of the option, and as a result, Meet the Press, to Tim Russert's happiness, the combined viewership here is among the highest in the nation. On September 11th, King, of course, carried NBC's coverage from New York, uninterrupted. But on Kong, we carried nonstop local coverage, the only station in a position to do so. We gave local viewers a chance to talk and grieve together as a community, and that night on Kong, we aired a live service from a local cathedral. Kong carried coverage throughout the week, uninterrupted. It did not go back to normal programming with commercials until after some other network affiliates had done so. In this very building, about a month after September 11th, a King 5 journalist moderated Seattle's portion of a five-city town hall meeting set up by the United Nations and sponsored by the Better World campaign. Kong carried the event from start to finish. In fact, I think Mr. Blethyn was on the panel. The only broadcaster to do so, and I suspect the only broadcaster to even consider doing so. On Election Day 2000, this nation was choosing a new leader, and our state was electing a governor, a senator, and all of our seats in the House. On Kong, we carried uninterrupted coverage of the local election. On King, we carried uninterrupted coverage of NBC's national coverage. Without the second station, we would have had to compromise with our viewers on both counts. On multiple occasions, when no network affiliate was carrying live coverage of a local news event, King has been the only station to do so. Our situation here is not unique. BLO has duopolies in four markets. In each of those markets, the acquired station previously provided no local news. Now, three of those four stations provide news, and the fourth is preparing to do so. One of those duopoly markets is here in Spokane. Although a smaller market, again, our ability to consolidate has allowed us to offer that market an additional choice of news that it did not have before. Thanks for the opportunity to appear before you, and I look forward to answering all questions.
Thank you all for your presentations. Let me ask a couple of questions and then ask Commissioner Adelstein if he has questions. Congressman Inslee, you obviously, as a member of Congress, deal with a whole range of issues. This is but one of many, but there are occasionally, I think, similarities in what you deal with. I know you were very heavily involved in working to mitigate problems in the energy markets that were caused to people in the Northwest following the energy deregulation. What lessons should we take away from the public's experience with energy deregulation as we begin to address this problem of further media deregulation?
I think one of the lessons is that when you deal with deregulation, frequently you'll have spectacularly optimistic projections of the future that will be based a lot on sort of the most virtuous players in the industry who project their plans. And there are many virtuous players in the energy industry, for instance. But what you don't hear from are the sort of dirtbags who are in the weeds who are figuring out a way to game the system. And those folks exist, too. And unfortunately, some of those people turned off 30% of the power in the West Coast last year, which generated this energy crisis we had. So when you go into a deregulation mode, you have to understand that perhaps the majority of folks in the industry are virtuous, but there are a few that are not, and you have to have a system that takes that into account. Now, what David said about his efforts, I will confirm the things he said, even in this audience, David. I'm happy to do that as far as some of their local efforts that they have made. But David is not Rupert Murdoch. And there are others out there who have... There are others who have different, you know, views about how to treat local competition and what they should put on their networks. And while some networks, and I frankly think King and Kong, have done a good job remaining a relatively balanced, neutral approach, others do not. Others see the networks and the public airways, which we own, as their private playpen. And they use that for purposes not for distribution of news, but distribution of their agenda. Okay? Now, having an agenda is not a problem. Having an agenda is not a problem. It is healthy to have an agenda. It's important to have an agenda. It's important to have people on the left and the right and the middle who have agendas. But it's imperative for democracy to have equal access to all points of the political spectrum for those various agendas. And I think that would be the lesson I would learn. And by the way, David, I hope you know that you had some dissenters in the crowd, but 98% of the Huskies treated you with respect.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Blatter,
Mr.
you...
Mr. Copps, excuse me just a moment. I may have to leave just briefly. I've got a call I've got to make, but I'll try to return here.
Thank you very much for being with us. Mr. Blatter, one of the more contentious of the rules that we're going to be looking at is this newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rule. And I know you have looked at this. I've tried to talk to a number of people on it, and a lot of them are trying to sell me on the idea that when you approach this rule, you really need to kind of differentiate between different markets, and that what might be appropriate in a smaller market might not be appropriate in a larger market, and perhaps in a city like Los Angeles or San Francisco or whatever, that maybe it would be okay to loosen the rule because you supposedly have so much diversity already existing in those markets. How would you respond to that, and what kind of guidance would you care to provide on that?
Well, you know, since we're talking about ducks, you know, if it looks like a duck, sounds like a duck, and walks like a duck, it probably is a duck. And it doesn't make any sense no matter what the size of market. You know, as I said in my prepared remarks, we're a very unusual animal because we are an independent newspaper company. We own six newspapers. Two of them are in eastern Washington in small Walla Walla and Yakima, small rural markets that have been in a depressed economy much longer than Seattle has been. And I can tell you, we do not need to own television stations in Yakima to survive. And indeed, if we did, we would control more of the marketplace. We could probably increase our ad rates, and we could cut out one other voice over there. So from our business perspective, it might make sense. But from a public policy standpoint, why anybody wants us to be able to control, to eliminate an advertising option or another news voice is beyond me. And in the large markets, it certainly makes no sense. Look at Los Angeles. It is appalling to think that Los Angeles no longer owns, no longer has a locally owned newspaper or television station. This is our third largest city in the country, second largest city in the country. And the media in that community is all run by the money changers from Wall Street now. It just makes no sense that in a community that large, you really need more voices and more outlets if you're going to get some of the diversity, if you're going to reach some of the cultural and political viewpoints that won't get expressed otherwise. Thank you.
I just have one question. I'm interested in the comment by Congressman Inslee that we haven't seen a lot of coverage about this issue on the national media, or for that matter, in many local media in this country. This is an issue of huge national importance, and yet there's this deadening silence. The question I have for you first, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Lugi, is do you believe that this is an indication, as the Congressman asserted, and as many believe, that there is not, in fact, total independence between journalists and the coverage that they make, or do you think there's another explanation for the fact that there's been virtually no coverage on national network television in this issue, even though the national networks have a policy of trying to increase their ability to consolidate? And to follow up on that, Mr. Bledin, if you could answer, your local paper, I believe, has done some coverage of this issue. Have you noticed, has your paper done a lot more coverage of this issue than other papers that are owned by companies that have a different policy outcome in mind, other companies that say want to get rid of the cross-ownership rule? And if so, do you think that that indicates that there is, in fact, a lack of independence on the part of the journalists that aren't covering the story?
Well, I'll go first to answer your part of the question, Commissioner. You know, as you know, I worked at WRC, and as you know, it's in the same building as the NBC News Bureau. They were our tenant. And no way do I think the journalists at NBC News in Washington are in any way influenced on the issue of covering that. In fact, would be repelled by the notion. That would be make them more likely to cover it. Why it hasn't been covered, I think, is a good question, and I don't have the answer to that. I'll stand by my first response.
Excuse me?
Well, first of all, I'm the general manager. There's a firewall on our station on local news. There is a reporter right there from our television station, but I didn't send him out here.
Let me just say, you know, Dave made a great point earlier when he talked about being respectful of other people's points of view. I'm certainly not bashful about criticizing public companies, but I have to tell you that there are some good guys, and BLO is one of the good guys. What makes them one of the good guys is, until not too many years ago, they were a locally owned newspaper, and only recently have they morphed into a publicly owned media company. That's instructive on a couple of levels. In the first decade or so when companies are in that position, they oftentimes retain the values, the same values that you get from localism. And Dave is a reflection of that. I'm not worried about King today, and we have to remember that King had a heck of an act to follow in the Bullet ownership, which may have written the book on localism in local broadcasting. I'm worried about when Dave is gone, and I'm worried about the next generation of money changers that will eventually control BLO. So I just encourage you all to appreciate Dave and BLO while we still have them. Jonathan, in response to your question, and I do differ with Dave here, I don't think there's any question there is a chill on coverage of this issue and coverage of issues that affect the business interest of the conglomerates that control the Coca-Cola company. Gene Kimmelman from the Consumers Union tells a story about AOL Time Warner cooking their books and none of the media that they own ever reporting on it. Thankfully, the Washington Post is still controlled by a family and actually did run the story. In our business, the thing that we need to be afraid of is not the things that are covered, but what isn't covered. And And when it comes to the business of the people that are controlling our media and making these changes, but you can see the way this chill comes through with the massive disinvestment that we have seen in our newsrooms in both electronic and publicly owned print newspapers in the last half dozen years. And you simply, I don't have to convince you, you just have to look at the absence of coverage, the total absence of either advance or post coverage on the hearing in Richmond last week.
Dean Savisky, do you want to make a comment?
Yeah, just to add, I'm very concerned about the figure that was mentioned earlier, and that 75% of the people surveyed have no knowledge of this issue. And indeed, studies have shown that in the context of the 1996 Act, there was not a lot of media coverage. But to sort of support what Dave was saying, and in fairness to some of my colleagues in the journalistic community, studies have also shown that there is not a lot of coverage of relatively arcane regulatory matters in general, and just as there are not a lot of journalists covering the issues of the FCC, they're similarly not looking at your colleagues in the other independent regulatory commissions as well as much as we should be, given the importance of those issues.
Well, you know, I don't think we're going to have the kind of national debate that I'm trying to encourage until we get the networks to begin covering this issue. And I heard... And I heard a report somewhere recently that when the commission teed up this proceeding, I think it was last September, early October, one network, and one network only, even mentioned the fact that we were calling up all of these ownership caps that could fundamentally alter the landscape of the American media. One network mentioned it one time at 4:45 in the morning. That's not what I call engaging a national debate on an important issue. Before we close, Dean Stavisky, I wonder if I could ask you to furnish some material for the record, if it wouldn't be too much trouble. You mentioned the Bureau of Labor Statistics figures on employees in the newsrooms and all. It would really be coming back with some granular information for those in the commission who insist on granularity of information to really have kind of a breakdown of the Northwest, Washington, Oregon, and whatever else you'd like to include. If you had those kind of figures, I think it would be very helpful just to see the direction and the tendencies in the employment. Could you do that?
I'll gather what I can, Commissioner.
Right. Let me thank all of you very much for being up here. I'm going to ask our second panel to come up. Let's have a round of applause for everybody. While the second panel is making its way up here, let me say that perhaps the most important part of this exercise today is going to be having the public microphone and the public comment, and we're going to have the next panel maybe or maybe not take a short break, have the third panel, and then we will open it up and stay here to hear the public comment.